billion people are hungry, 2 billion suffering from diseases related to bad food.
You have been listening to Dr. Vandana Shiva, scientist, feminist, and ecological activist, October 20th, 2014, in Berkeley, California. The second part will be released in a later program. The website for the Navdanya Institute is www.navdanya.org. Wings thanks radio station KPFA for use of its audio. For Wings, I'm Kelia Ramirez Watson in Berkeley, California.
Tune in next week for the rest of Vandana Shiva's powerful speech in California.
We'll have to be more brilliant than we've ever been, more resilient than we've ever been, more courageous than we've ever been.
To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org, and please like our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thanks to all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
It is 12 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up next is Democracy Now! Views expressed in this syndicated program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of CFRC 101.9 FM, Radio Queen's University.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca. Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
What we are asking you now is please, please stay inside. Stay inside until we can get out there with our teams. They are all in action right now. We can get out there, assess the damage, and make sure that it's safe for you to go back out into your community or to re-enter your neighborhood.
Residents in Florida are being urged to stay inside after Hurricane Milton swept across the state, triggering deadly tornadoes, flooding, and record rainfall. In St. Petersburg, the roof was ripped off Tropicana Field, the home of the Tampa Bay Rays baseball team. The storm came just 2 weeks after Hurricane Helene hit Florida and other southeastern states, killing over 230 people. We'll go to St. Petersburg, Florida, which experienced a 1-in-1,000-year rainstorm, and also look at how the back-to-back storms have impacted prisoners and farm workers in Florida. Plus, we'll look at how the climate crisis is fueling stronger and deadlier storms.
Back-to-back disasters used to be unthinkable, and they're becoming ever more frequent. And with Helene and Milton hitting Florida twice in 2 weeks, it's just a reminder that for all of the happy talk about renewables and all the political debate about the green transition, the big story really is climate change. It's accelerating, and its impacts are going to be getting much worse.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, an Israeli air attack on a school-turned-shelter in central Deir al-Balah killed at least 28 people. Reporters describe chaotic scenes at Al-Aqsa Hospital where victims, most of them women and children, are being treated. Meanwhile, Israel's escalating its bloody siege on northern Gaza. Doctors at three hospitals are struggling to care for patients after Israel ordered their evacuation. Al Jazeera reports Israeli ground troops have surrounded Khan al-Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia and are threatening staff and patients. Israel also ordered the evacuation of Al-Auda and Indonesian hospitals. The group Medical Aid for Palestinians says it's removed newborn babies from Khan al-Adwan Hospital, but that ambulances are being detained at military checkpoints as they attempt to reach Gaza City. The humanitarian group warned, quote, the world must act before Gaza is erased entirely, unquote. The World Health Organization also said it was prevented by Israel yesterday from carrying out the forced evacuations. Kamal Adwan doctors warned 30 infants in the neonatal unit will die if Israel does not end its attack. And UNRWA is warning, quote, Gazans are yet again teetering on the edge of a man-made famine, unquote, as a result of Israel's latest siege on northern Gaza. Israel's attacks on journalists continue as well. On Wednesday, an airstrike on the Jabalia refugee camp killed Al-Aqsa cameraman Mohammed Al-Thanani and injured the reporter Tamer Labad. An Al Jazeera Arabic camera operator, Fadi Al-Wahidi, was also injured while covering attacks on Jabalia, shot in the neck by an Israeli quadcopter. This is his colleague, journalist Anas Al-Sharif, detailing the attack.
Suddenly, a quadcopter drone appeared above the broadcast vehicle and the place where we were, and it started firing directly at us, at the broadcast vehicle, and at the colleagues and team who were with me. My colleague Fadi was next to me, so we started running. As soon as we began to run from the location, the drone started chasing us and the entire crew, firing directly at us. A bullet hit my colleague Fadi's neck directly, and he immediately passed out and fell to the ground.
Another Al Jazeera cameraman, Ali Alata, also remains in critical condition after being shot earlier this week while reporting in Deir al-Balah. In Khan Yunis, Israel killed at least five members of the same family, three of them children, including a seven-month-old baby. This comes as a new report by the International Rescue Committee reveals over 50,000 Palestinian children in Gaza have been orphaned or separated from their parents over the past year. Israeli attacks on the occupied West Bank are also ongoing, killing at least five Palestinians Wednesday, including the leader of the group Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in Nablus. Separately, new UN data show there was an average of four incidents of settler violence every day against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since October 7th last year. Israel bombardment of southern Lebanon killed five paramedics Wednesday. Israel has killed at least 115 health workers in Lebanon over the past several weeks. The UN special coordinator for Lebanon called for an immediate halt to attacks to create space for a political solution.
The joint call for a 21-day ceasefire, as launched by the U.S. or led by the U.S. and France, I think is still on the table and very relevant. So we should not dismiss it. I don't think that new initiatives will add to it. I mean, the many appeals and calls for ceasefire are crystal clear. We need a window for diplomatic efforts to succeed.
Over 1 million people in Lebanon have been displaced since Israel launched its deadly campaign.
I have been here from the south for 8 days. I sent my family 2 to 3 days before me. My wife gave birth, so I came here for my family. I will go back south again. We will not leave our land. It is an expensive land. We are offering martyrs. We are offering blood.
Israel has also launched more strikes in Syria, targeting Homs and Hama provinces. Meanwhile, Israel is expected to launch an imminent attack on Iran after Tehran struck Israeli military bases with ballistic missiles October 1st. Iran's attacks, which targeted Israeli security sites, came amidst Israel's escalating attacks and acts of terror against Lebanon and after its assassination of the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. This is Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant.
Whoever attacks us will be hurt and will pay a price. Our attack will be deadly, precise, and above all, surprising. They will not understand what happened and how it happened.
On Wednesday, President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris spoke on the phone with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in their first call in nearly 2 months. A White House readout of the call highlights Biden's statement of his ironclad support for Israel. It makes no mention of ceasefire. More than 3 million customers in Florida are without power after Hurricane Milton made landfall in Sarasota County Wednesday evening as a Category 3 storm with 120-mile-an-hour winds. Multiple deaths were confirmed after tornadoes tore through a senior center in Fort Pierce. 116 tornado warnings were issued across Florida Wednesday. In St. Petersburg, the storm ripped the roof off of Tropicana Field, the home of the Tampa Bay Rays baseball team. A massive crane also collapsed in downtown St. Petersburg. Ahead of making landfall, President Biden warned Milton could be the storm of the century. Tampa's mayor called the scale of evacuation unprecedented. Milton comes just 2 weeks after Hurricane Helene battered Florida and other southeastern states, killing at least 230 people. A new analysis by the group World Weather Attribution finds the burning of fossil fuels has made highly destructive storms like Helene more than twice as likely. Florida climate activists have declared Republican Governor Ron DeSantis unfit to lead the state since his policies promote fossil fuels, reject sustainable energy options, and ignore the climate crisis. Meanwhile, officials, including Florida Republicans, are working to combat misinformation about the storms pushed by their fellow Republicans, including the recent assertion by the far-right Georgia's Congress member Marjorie Taylor Greene that the government is controlling the weather. We'll go to Florida after headlines for the latest on Hurricane Milton. A new report by the Worldwide Fund for Nature reveals wildlife populations have declined by over 70% on average over the past half century. The Living Planet report warns key habitats like the Amazon are reaching tipping points with catastrophic consequences for many species. This is Dr. Robin Freeman from the Zoological Society of London, which produces the Living Planet Index.
This year's Living Planet report is the most comprehensive data set we've collected to date. We've got almost 35,000 populations of 5,400 species, and using that data set, we've estimated that populations have declined by an average of 73% since 1972. The combination of climate change, habitat loss, and biodiversity loss are things that we need to get on top of because they're a mixed-up problem that need to be dealt with together.
The report comes just 10 days before the next major UN biodiversity conference, dubbed COP16, is set to begin in Cali, Colombia. A new report from Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse confirms then-President Trump significantly curtailed the FBI's 2018 investigation into Brett Kavanaugh as his confirmation to become a Supreme Court justice hung in the balance. After Christine Blasey Ford testified that Kavanaugh had sexually assaulted her at a party when they were high school students, Trump approved a one-week-long FBI investigation into the allegations amidst a public uproar over Kavanaugh's nomination. But despite claims by Trump the FBI had free rein in their probe, his staff ordered the FBI to only interview 10 witnesses and not to pursue the many tips or offers of corroborating evidence the agency received. Lawyers for Blasey Ford said the report confirmed the 2018 investigation was a, quote, sham effort directed by the Trump White House to silence brave victims, unquote. Talks between Boeing and some 33,000 striking workers in the Pacific Northwest have collapsed, with Boeing rescinding a 30% pay increase offer earlier this week. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, which launched the strike nearly a month ago, is seeking a 40% pay raise and improved retirement benefits. This comes as the Federal Aviation Administration this week issued a safety warning to airlines related to the rudders of some Boeing 737 airplanes. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting Boeing declined a request by Ethiopia Airlines chief pilot to provide guidance on how to handle problems with the 737 MAX flight control system in the wake of 2018's Lion Air crash in Indonesia. 3 months after the denied request, an Ethiopia Airlines crash from the same flawed flight control system, killing all 157 people on board. This year's Nobel Prize for Literature has been awarded to the South Korean author Han Kang, quote, for her intense poetic prose that confronts historical traumas and exposes the fragility of human life, unquote. Han Kang, author of The Vegetarian and The White Book, is the first South Korean author and just the 18th woman to win the prestigious award since it was inaugurated in 1901. And in a blow to the student Palestinian solidarity movement, Brown University voted against divesting from 10 companies that are complicit in Israel's occupation of and war on Palestinian territories. In a social media post condemning the news, the Brown Divest Coalition warned, quote, all settler colonial institutions will fail, unquote. Students across the country are marking a week of rage with die-ins, walkouts, and other actions to protest 1 year of genocide in Gaza and Israel's escalating war on Lebanon. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More than 3 million people in Florida are without power after Hurricane Milton made landfall in Sarasota County Wednesday as a Category 3 storm with 120-mile-an-hour winds. The storm came just 2 weeks after Hurricane Helene battered Florida and other southeastern states, killing at least 230 people, making it one of the deadliest storms in the last decades. Officials in Florida have just begun assessing the damage caused by Hurricane Milton, from wind damage to flash flooding. Multiple deaths were confirmed after tornadoes tore through a senior center in Fort Pierce. Overall, 116 tornado warnings were issued across Florida Wednesday. In St. Petersburg, the storm ripped off the roof of Tropicana Field, the home of the Tampa Bay Rays baseball team. A massive crane also collapsed in downtown St. Petersburg, where more than 9 inches of rain fell in just 3 hours. CNN described it as a 1-in-1,000-year rainstorm. Earlier this morning, Tampa Mayor Jane Castor urged residents to stay inside.
What we are asking you now is please, please stay inside. Stay inside until we can get out there with our teams. They are all in action right now. We can get out there, assess the damage, and make sure that it's safe for you to go back out into your community or to re-enter your neighborhood.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today's show in St. Petersburg, where we're joined on the phone by Florida State Representative Michelle Rayner, who's among the millions who lost power in the storm. State Representative Rayner, welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm sorry it's under these circumstances. I know you've moved from one place to another. St. Petersburg has experienced a 1-in-1,000 year rainstorm. Can you describe, as the sun comes up, what you see and the devastation, and then link it to the kind of help that is being offered and what the governor is saying of Florida, DeSantis?
Thank you so much, Amy. And it is, I'm glad to be back. Definitely not under these circumstances. And can y'all hear me okay, by the way?
We hear you perfectly. And I should explain to our listeners and viewers that usually we have you on screen, but because you've lost electricity, we just have you on the phone. Go ahead.
Correct. Correct. So, yeah, we have no power. There's no internet right now. There's also no ability to use water. So the water has been shut down here. I evacuated my home, which is in evacuation zone B over by a lake in St. Petersburg. I came more inland into St. Petersburg, but I'm still here. I walked out of my best friend's home, and trees and limbs are down here. The reports I've been getting from county and city officials, you know, as you mentioned in the intro, the Tropicana Field top was blown off. Cranes have been knocked into other buildings. There has been flooding. I was born and raised in Pinellas County. I have lived here off and on my whole life. You know, I have never experienced a storm quite like this. It is it is disheartening. I don't even know what my own home looks like right now. So I can't even get there to see what that looks like. You know, as far as the help that the governor is proposing, you know, right now everything is up in the air. We don't know. I'm concerned because, you know, he was already ahead of the storm playing political games, not taking phone calls from Vice President Kamala Harris, making this political members of his party, spreading disinformation around FEMA. And this is just not the time. This is not the time for these type of games. This is not the time for these type of shenanigans. It's just not. We have people, we don't know what the loss of life looks like right now. We have people that were devastated by Helene that now have the double trauma of Milton, who lost everything in Helene, who now has probably have lost maybe even more. So I am hopeful that all of us will work together and put, you know, aside these games. But it is, I also know who I'm dealing with. So I, you know, I'm hopeful that we would be able to do that. I mean, and the reason I say I know who I'm dealing with, last 2 weeks ago when Helene ripped into Florida, I had the idea for the state to lift the moratorium on to lift the bans on short-term rental, because here in the state of Florida, you can only have a short-term rental for about 14 days. And I had the idea for the state to lift that and say, you know, I'll lift the bans on the short-term rentals. I knew that I couldn't call the governor. I knew that if I tweeted it, I knew if I sent a letter about it, I knew he would immediately not even entertain it. So I had to have other people serve as intermediaries and give him this idea so he would think that it was his idea in order for him to do that. So I know who I'm dealing with.
And Representative Rayner, I'm wondering the evacuation of more than 5 million people. This was the largest in Florida history. How did that go? And what about these reports that there was a price gouging at many gas stations?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I live near, you know, a major interstate that gets you out of Florida or gets you down south. And it was gridlocked. My best friend, whose house I'm staying at, her and her wife, they drove to Miami. Miami is maybe a 3.5 hour drive. It took them 6 hours to get there, right? And we have seen price gouging, not only of hotels, but Airbnbs, of gas, of all of these people to contact Ashley Moody's office. She's from General Florida. Contact her office, report it, take pictures of it. This is not the time people to be preying on folks' vulnerability.
I also wanted to ask you about the rumors that are going around. I should say the lies of people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, but it goes beyond her state in Georgia, who says that the government is manipulating the weather, the denial of climate change, and also that FEMA will not be providing money, and how this can be a life and death situation. It's not just misinformation, but if people believe this, how you're dealing with this in Florida. State representative.
So right now, a lot of us are in.
We may have lost State Representative Michelle Rayner. She was just speaking to us on the phone. Yes, go ahead. Your answer, State Representative.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you now. I know this is a tough situation.
So, yeah. Yeah, it is. So I give kudos to our city and county partners and state officials. You know, we are releasing videos. We are releasing information on social media. We are making sure that our constituents know that that's patently not true, that no one's coming to take your house, that if you apply for any FEMA funding, that has nothing to do with your taking your home or any of these things that that have been falsely put out there. And so it's really just us providing that information to people. I know that we're going to have teams of folks going door to door, letting people know about what is available to them in this time, not only on the city, county, and state, but also federal level. But once again, these are people that spread these lies. It is just completely not the time. And it's heartbreaking. I mean, people have already lost so much. They've already lost so much. Why would you do this in this time? Why would you do this in the time where people need help? Things cost money, people. Why would you do this?
You're breaking up, State Representative Michelle Rayner, but we thank you so much for being with us, and we're going to check back with you as the sun just comes up in Florida right now. Democratic Florida State Representative. We're going to break, and when we come back, we're going to go to another hard-hit Florida city, to Orlando, to talk with a student there engaged in climate change activism. His dorm is being used as a shelter as we speak. Stay with us.
The world is changing all the time, and you know it ain't right. Yeah, I know you think twice. And love, it takes you on a ride and leaves you with no respite. Well, I think I've done my time, but I don't want to. So take me where the bluebirds sing, while we lose everything. There's too much poisoning. And fly me where the birds still fly, 'cause smoke fills up our sky. 'Cause we ran time. Oh well, we tried.
We Tried by Louise Harris, a musician and climate activist. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Hurricane Milton comes just 2 weeks after Hurricane Helene battered Florida and other southeastern states, killing at least 230 people. A new analysis by the group World Weather Attribution finds the burning of fossil fuels has made highly destructive storms like Helene more than twice as likely. Florida climate activists have declared Republican Governor Ron DeSantis unfit to lead the state, since his policies promote fossil fuels, reject sustainable energy options, and ignore or deny the climate crisis. We're joined now by two guests. In our New York studio, David Wallace Wells is with us, New York Times opinion writer, columnist for the New York Times Magazine. His recent piece is headlined Sleeping Through Hurricane Helene, author of the book The Uninhabitable Earth. But we're going first to Manuel Ivan Guerrero, an 18-year-old freshman at the University of Central Florida, UCF. He's an organizer with the Sunrise Movement, helping with hurricane rapid response, and has just called on major TV networks to hold a climate hurricane town hall with the presidential candidates Kamala Harris and Donald Trump on October 17th, the day early voting begins in the swing state of North Carolina, parts of which were just devastated by Hurricane Helene. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin in Orlando with Manuel. Describe what the situation is right there, Manuel, and where you're living, the number of people who had to evacuate, how intense the rain was, and what you're calling for.
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me. And the situation here at UCF is honestly a lot better than the rest of the city of Orlando. There's footage and there's stuff from the off-campus housing near UCF and downtown Orlando of trees falling down and buildings that are still without power at this time, even as the hurricane left 6-7 hours ago. And in general, Orlando is in a much better position than Tampa due to not being on the coast, but it's still really, really nowhere near where it should be. And honestly, this just has me more scared for what the future is going to look like in Florida and how the landscape of Florida is going to look like 10, 15 years from now when we're having these 1,000-year storms every 3-4 years now. And we're definitely extremely concerned about the way that it's going to affect our community and the people that haven't been able to evacuate. Many, many people weren't able to evacuate either for economic reasons or because of shortages. People aren't able to evacuate from two storms back to back in this way. When you can't afford rent, you can't really afford to buy $300 of gas money and then a hotel somewhere you've never been to before. And what we're really fighting for is to make the Biden-Harris administration focus on this as a climate issue and to make it a top three priority for them in this coming election, because we need a candidate that's really fighting for climate. And that's why we're calling for this hurricane town hall, specifically in North Carolina, probably the most affected state by hurricanes at the moment, a state in cities that 10 years ago would have been unimaginable to have flooding in Asheville. And that destruction that we saw in Asheville and the destruction that now we're seeing in Tampa and in downtown Orlando are things that we really should not be seeing at the moment. Things that are completely unprecedented levels of damage. And the way that this hurricane intensified 3-4 categories in 12-15 hours is unprecedented. And we should really, really be focused on that.
And Manuel, can you talk about the situation where Florida, which has been ravaged for decades by major hurricanes, but increasingly has become a danger zone for climate change, having a governor who's a climate crisis denier?
Honestly, with the leadership that we have in Florida right now, they don't listen to the needs of Florida. Of Floridians, we are at the front line of the climate crisis, and all they focus on is the crisis in the moment of the hurricane and not the root cause. Like, it's like Ron DeSantis sent garbage trucks to Tampa last week to pick up trash before Hurricane Milton and due to the debris from Hurricane Helene. Yet he refuses to see the fact that climate change is the cause for this, and we know this for a fact. And we can see the way that fossil fuels are causing these issues, and we can see the intensification and the heat that's causing all of this to happen. And the way that we've been specifically, even Republican leadership in the state that has recognized the fact that the climate change does exist, as Rick Scott said 2 weeks ago after Hurricane Helene, they still refuse to recognize the reason that the climate is changing. And that is the fossil fuel investment that we have in the state of Florida and the focus that we have on fossil fuels and the fossil fuel lobby that exists so deeply within the state.
I just wanted to play a clip from the Republican presidential debate last year. All 8 participants declined to raise their hands when asked by Fox News moderator Martha McCallum if human activity is to blame for the climate crisis. This is how Florida Governor Rick DeSantis responded.
Do you believe in human behavior is causing climate change? Raise your hand if you do.
Well, look, we're not school children. Let's have the debate. I mean, I'm happy to take it to start. Okay. Alexander, so do you want to raise your hand or not? I don't think that's the way to do it.
So, David Wallace-Wells, if you can respond, I mean, we're talking about a state where the governor, many have described as a major climate denier, what this means, and, you know, emblematic of many in the country.
Yeah, I think the story is much bigger than Ron DeSantis. I mean, we're talking about, you know, Donald Trump campaigning in part on Project 25's promises to defund FEMA and cut emergency services and disaster response. We are seeing all of this disinformation surrounding Hurricane Helene, with people posting on social media about FEMA helicopters shooting down disaster relief, people circulating conspiracy theories about land being seized by the federal government, not to mention, as you highlighted earlier, Marjorie Taylor Greene's suggestion that the weather itself is man-made and controlled by the government. And there's a kind of a grim irony in those who deny that human activity can be driving the climate crisis, but who believe that government actors can control the weather to this scale. I think we're entering into a really dark new phase, reckoning with the climate crisis, when, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, climate activists would have told you when the stuff really starts to hit the fan, people are going to wake up. But I think what we've seen over the last few weeks shows us, unfortunately, that when the stuff's hitting the fan, many, many people are choosing instead to retreat into little cocoons of disinformation and paranoia. And that scares me in some ways even more than the weather itself.
And David Wallace Wells, what's the estimated cost of damages from these hurricanes? You've noted that the costs may well exceed the total green investment in the U.S. for the year.
Yeah, well, the damages for Hurricane Milton, we still don't know. It seems likely to be a less damaging storm than people feared a few days ago because of the path. And that's a reminder of just how precarious all of this is. A storm moves 10 or 20 miles in one direction, and it can go from being a $100 billion disaster to being a $5 billion disaster. That's how much we are already living on the knife's edge. But we have pretty good preliminary estimates for the damages from Hurricane Helene. And those are, at the moment, about $175 billion. That is an enormous number. And to put it into context, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that the total green spending contained in the Inflation Reduction Act, which we're celebrating rightly as the biggest climate investment in American history, the total green investment there, the Congressional Budget Office has estimated, is $369 billion, and that's over a 10-year time period. This one storm, Hurricane Helene, delivered almost half of the damage that the IRA has been estimated to pay out in green outlays. And I think there's an even bigger context to understand there, too, which is a storm that hit Nepal simultaneously with Hurricane Helene here in the U.S. that killed also 200 people and devastated the country of Nepal. The damage there was estimated at only $175 million, which is to say that storms of incredible catastrophic impact around the world are tallied as unbelievably trivial compared to the damage in the U.S., not because the storm itself was less intense, not because the loss of life was any less severe, not because the damage was any less grim, but just because when we tally these things in dollars, we actually value the lives and the property of people living elsewhere in the world dramatically less than we value the lives and property of people living in the U.S. In fact, that differential is a thousandfold differential between the way that we calculate the damage of Hurricane Helene and the way that we calculated the damage from the flooding in Nepal. That is grotesque. It is on some level natural that Americans experience a form of climate narcissism and focus on what's happening in their backyard. But I think it's always important to take the global picture and see how much worse those living elsewhere in the world with many less resources to respond and to adapt than we have are suffering even more intensely than we are here in the U.S.
To follow up on that global perspective, in the last months, we've seen the typhoon Babinka in China, extreme monsoons in India, and heat waves across the Mediterranean. And many of these countries have less resources, as you mentioned, to deal with them. Yet the American public is almost unaware of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned the flooding in Nepal, but at the same time as that was happening, there was also a hurricane hitting Acapulco. That was the second major hurricane to hit Acapulco in a year. The one that hit last summer was perhaps the most dramatic hurricane that we've seen in the age of climate crisis. This was a hurricane that intensified from a pretty quotidian tropical storm to a Category 5 monster in the space of 24 hours. And unlike Hurricane Milton, which was projected to intensify over the course of that period, meteorologists who are looking at the Hurricane Otis in Acapulco were completely taken by surprise, which meant that last year that city was almost unable to evacuate. They
had so little warning ahead of the storm. They had a similar deluge 2 weeks ago as we were watching Hurricane Helene, and that's a city that is now again underwater for the second time in 2 years. So, you know, these are storms that seem to demand our full attention when we look at any one of them, and yet there are often multiple of them going on around the world at any one time, which is just another mark of what a different universe of climate impacts and global warming we're living in now, already entirely outside the window of temperatures that enclosed human history. We are running an experiment, a dangerous experiment, to see how much of the human civilization we've brought with us to this point can survive these new climate conditions, and we're going to be finding out the answer to that question in the coming decades, unfortunately.
Relating to this issue of what happens in the rest of the world and how little we pay attention, comes the issue of what we do in this country, how we build this country as one of the leading climate change, sadly, promoters in the world, causes of climate change, this country, the United States. There's a new research paper finding that in the months after a hurricane landfall, communities experienced between, 7,000 and 11,000 excess deaths, far above the official estimates. In what way? And why is insurance an important driver of what should actually be sustainable development?
Yeah, the paper about hurricane mortality is really eyebrow-raising and harrowing, and it's just been published, and you know, some scientists are still looking at the data, trying to figure out exactly what's going on there. But the basic story is that when a major hurricane hits, everything is disrupted. Medical services are disrupted, power goes out, people's lives are interrupted, and those can have knock-on effects, especially in dense communities where vulnerable people ultimately succumb to things that they would have been able to survive in other contexts. This impact, the researchers of this and the authors of this paper suggest, could account for as much as 5% of total deaths in these areas just from the hurricanes that we're seeing. It's a quite grim reminder of just how deadly all of these storms can be. We've gotten much better at evacuating, as the evacuations in Florida this week show, but we're still not protecting people nearly enough. And that goes for the direct mortality impacts. It also goes for the longer term impacts on lives and livelihood. And that's, I think, where the insurance question comes in. Over the last few years, we've seen historic losses across the insurance business, driven in part by climate change. And in places like Florida and California, it's really becoming quite unclear who will be protecting those who need protection. If your house is flooded or destroyed, who will help you rebuild? In North Carolina, we saw the intense center of Hurricane Helene flooding, Asheville and its county, Bonneville County. Less than 1% of the homes in that county carried flood insurance. Less than 1%. Many of these homes were literally destroyed. Many more of them were damaged considerably. And many of those people living there will have absolutely nowhere to turn for help. They're not people living in Malibu who have, you know, millions of dollars to spend on a new house after a wildfire. These are people who are quite vulnerable, and both the private insurance system and the federal flood insurance system have very, very little to offer them. I think what we're being told by these disasters is that we need to do much, much more to protect people in harm's way, and that many more people are really in harm's way than we thought just even a few years ago.
And David, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned earlier Project 2025 with this presidential election less than a month away and a very close race. What are your concerns about how a potential Trump presidency would deal with the issue of the climate?
Well, I'm glad to be here talking about it today, because I actually think a lot of the green energy transition stuff that has been going on in the aftermath of the IRA will probably continue, because the political logic of the green investment boom in places like Texas is somewhat undeniable. We're probably going to continue building out green energy somewhat rapidly. But on the adaptation and disaster management side, I'm really, really quite concerned. In Project 2025, they call for the privatization of the hurricane forecasting system, which would mean you'd have to pay for good information about where hurricanes were coming. Donald Trump, when he was last president, tried to cut disaster relief in FEMA by as much as two-thirds. As we've seen in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene, he also refused to send disaster relief to certain states based on whether the constituents had voted for him in sufficient numbers. This is really a recipe for disaster, because in any four-year period, it's likely that extreme weather is going to intensify. And while I do think that the green transition is likely to continue at some speed under a Trump presidency, I think that there be much less humane response from the federal government to disasters like these, and much less proactively spent and invested in adaptation and preparation, which is really what we need. We can't only be rushing to the scene of a disaster after it hits. We need to be able to prepare those communities, which is to say all American communities, ahead of time for what's coming. Asheville is a perfect example of this. FEMA has actually, I think, done a relatively good job, all of the conspiracy theories notwithstanding, but a community that is hit without preparation is going to be devastated. That's what it means to be living in a world defined by weather we have not seen for all of human history. And that is the experience that we're having now. The climate that we're living in now is unprecedented in all of human history. That means unprecedented risks, unprecedented hazards. We need to be preparing for those ahead of time as though they are unprecedented, not as though they are just normal weather, which is how many on the Republican side of the aisle want to see them.
And before Manuel Ivan Guerrero, you go, I wanted to ask you, in Orlando, as a student at UCF, if these catastrophes, this one Hurricane Helene after another Milton, following up on this question around the presidential election, how it's affected young people in the swing. I mean, we're talking about swing states of North Carolina, the key state of Florida.
It's been very disconcerting for young people. Also, I just lost power, if you didn't notice from the lighting change. We just, like, on air. But it's been very disconcerting to lots of young people to see. And it has been very stimulating for those conversations. I hear many of the people on my floor who stayed for the hurricane, who don't usually talk about the election, talking about the way that this has been mismanaged and the way that this is so concerning, the fact that we had two hurricanes in 2 weeks, and the way that it's affected our schooling, and it's affected, like, the people that we know and our family members that live in Tampa, and all of those things. And that's really had people conversing about the election and really talking about the effects of these climate disasters and the way it's going to affect our communities and our families and our futures.
Well, Manuel Ivan Guerrero, we want to thank you for being with us, University of Central Florida organizer with the Sunrise Movement. Even though your electricity went out, your lights went out, you shed great light on the subject. And David Wallace Wells, please stay with us, New York Times opinion writer. We'll link to your new piece, Sleeping Through Hurricane Helene, author of the book The Uninhabitable Earth. But as we talk about evacuations and who gets saved and who doesn't, we're going to go to Immokalee to talk about Florida farm workers. And we're going to look at the prisons of these hard-hit states. Do prisoners, are they protected? Back in 20 seconds.
Don't you think it's concerning? The earth is heating up. I mean, we're practically burning. Fossil fuels keep on burning. The corporates are earning and earning. The survival of a race comes second place to the profits lining their pockets. Don't you think it's alarming? Through ignorance, it is our own livelihoods we're disregarding. The polar caps are melting. How many views and likes you are counting?
Do Something by Celia Hapida. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As many as 28,000 people incarcerated in Florida jails and prisons were in the mandatory evacuation zone for Hurricane Milton. But many officials refused to relocate the prisoners and insisted their facilities were safe. Meanwhile, an incarcerated person who was evacuated to a Florida maximum security prison shared their experience last night on social media. Quote, "Power's out in here, and the correctional officers are hiding in their offices while we're left in the dark. We're shouting for meds and updates, but no one's listening. Just trying to hold on and hope this storm doesn't swallow us whole," unquote. For more, we're joined by Jordan Martinez, an organizer with the Campaign to Fight Toxic Prisons and the group's Hurricane and Disaster Response Team. They helped organize pressure campaigns for officials to evacuate incarcerated people during this storm, as they have for many others. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Jordan, explain what the situation has been now in Florida for prisoners.
Yeah, the ongoing situation, Amy, in Florida has been one of almost complete neglect and fiction writing by the Florida Department of Corrections and various county sheriff's offices, jails, et cetera, claiming that incarcerated people are, in fact, being evacuated. The Florida Department of Corrections claims 5,600 almost incarcerated people were evacuated. But in the list of facilities that they released, the vast majority of those evacuated were from work camps, halfway houses, work release centers, and in many cases, they were evacuated to quote-unquote hardened facilities literally across the street. For example, Lowell Work Camp, which is part of Lowell Correctional Institution Women's Prison that organizers in Florida with Change Comes Now have been fighting around various conditions. Lowell Work Camp evacuated dozens of yards away to Lowell Correctional. And so we're seeing this fiction being raised by FDOC as well as the county sheriffs. We attempted to help force evacuations in multiple mandatory evacuation zones along the West Coast, and we were able to achieve one evacuation of the Orient Road Jail in Hillsborough County, but Manatee County, Lee County, Pinellas County, as well as St. John's County on the eastern coast, all left prisoners in mandatory evacuation zones in the jails.
And Jordan, you mentioned Pinellas County. The sheriff there stated that, quote, it's really not possible to evacuate the jail because of the number of inmates, and he instead moved people to higher floors. Can you talk about that?
I think this is, again, part of the fiction that the sheriffs and officials in Florida like to spin to project a sense of confidence in the face of conditions that are entirely unpredictable in hurricane situations. For the vast majority of hurricanes that we've organized around, the actually most dangerous portions of the hurricanes are not the immediate storm surges that might flood the first floor of a prison, jail, or detention center. It's actually the aftermath in the days and weeks following, in which water is cut off, access to food is cut off, power is cut off, medical supplies are cut off. And so evacuating people to higher floors when the bottom floor is completely destroyed that houses the majority of those facilities that keep the entire system running within the prison that people need to survive their basic living necessities, it can create conditions in which, as has been reported on Democracy Now! Before, people are forced to drink water from the toilet because they have no other access. And we see this again and again and again in disaster situations. And the fact that they are unable to evacuate people in mandatory evacuation zones, I think, goes to show the complete lack of prioritization of the lives of incarcerated people during hurricanes. And I think we can all agree, if we are prioritizing the safety of our communities, those communities must include the incarcerated people inside that are themselves organizing on the inside to fight for better conditions and quite often being forced during hurricanes to prepare to protect their communities via forced slave labor with sandbags or in cleanup in the aftermath.
And Ginny, The Intercept reports prisoners in North Carolina were left in their cells without running water or power for nearly a week, cut off from communication with the outside world and forced to keep their waste in plastic bags in their cells from Helene. Your final comments on what needs to be done?
I think the final comments on what needs to be done is there needs to be mandatory in-place rules and regulations during evacuations when a certain category of hurricane is coming in that require and force state and local county officials to have evacuation plans in preparation in advance. And lastly, I want to close with a quote from inside that we have with Jailhouse Lawyers Speak, who are the folks that reported those inside conditions, and we believe it's very important that incarcerated people are allowed to speak for themselves in these conditions. So this is coming out of the Florida Department of Corrections itself. Jailhouse Lawyer Speak says, we urge the public to understand our plight as people in jails and prisons. We suffer during natural disasters in locked, dark cells, not knowing if we will survive or not. This is not just a logistical failure, it's a profound moral failing. While entire towns are evacuated and communities band together to seek safety, we remain locked within these walls, treated as less than human. It is heartbreaking to think that while the world prepares for survival during a pending natural disaster such as Hurricane Milton, we are still treated as if we don't matter, as if our lives can be tossed aside in the name of protocol. We must end this normalized routine. We beg the public to pay attention and have a heart of compassion.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Jay or Jordan Martinez, an organizer with the Campaign to Fight Toxic Prisons, the group's Hurricane and Disaster Response Team. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we continue our coverage of Hurricane Milton and its aftermath, we're joined by Gerardo Reyes Chavez, a farm worker organizer with a coalition of Immokalee workers in southwest Florida, which also runs a radio station called Radio Consciencia, which helped immigrant workers prepare for Hurricane Milton and other storms. He lives in Florida, but is joining us from Las Vegas, where he just landed. If you can place for us Immokalee and talk about what you understand has taken place right now.
Yes. Good morning, Amy. Thank you for inviting us. Immokalee is a farm worker community that was created as a labor reserve. And it is also the epicenter for the production of tomatoes with companies that are based on that area with production on the entire East Coast. And in Immokalee, we have workers that come from Mexico, Guatemala, Haiti, and other workers from Central America. We are a very vulnerable community that also has been the epicenter of the fight for human rights in the fields for decades. We have been able to establish agreements with 14 major corporations to create some collaboration that has helped us in minimizing some of the vulnerabilities that we have faced for many, many years. By working together in moments of crisis like this one.
And if you can also, Gerardo, talk about the radio station. Yesterday, we had on the news director of WMNF in Tampa, who was covering Gulfport in Florida. And your radio station, that is so key, these community radio stations to linking up people and the kind of mutual aid that needs to be done.
Our community radio station has been broadcasting since 2003. And during all of these years, we have had broadcastings in different languages, indigenous languages, and in Spanish, which is the main language that most people speak, also in Creole. And through the radio, we have been communicating all the messages so that people know where to go and what's going on in regards to, in this case, the hurricanes. So one of the key things about our community radio station is that its nickname, it's yours, it's La Tuya, which means it's something that we have created with the community. In fact, the first library we had was donations of music from the community itself. And the participation of the community in the programming, it's very important, as well as the organizing efforts of the coalition of Immokalee workers that are what makes possible this trust in the information that a community that is so vulnerable needs to hear to be able to then go to the shelters, for example. People follow those instructions. And we know that in many different circumstances, we have been able to direct people and safeguard our community by collaborating with the community also in all of these efforts. So for us, it's a very important tool And it is a space in which, you know, we convey the information that have helped us save lives, no doubt.
And Geraldo, we only have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about the housing conditions of many of the migrant workers that you deal with. They're usually dilapidated or poorly constructed housing. How are they unduly affected by storms like this?
Well, this is always scary for us. You know, whenever a hurricane hits on our area, it's, as you mentioned, mobile homes are really, really old. They are not safe places to be. Something that I have seen, you know, is through the agreements that we have established with the Fair Food Program, there has been changes on the housing for workers inside Fair Food Program farms. But sadly, the conditions of vulnerability, living conditions especially, are horrible in most agricultural communities. So what we are seeing, it's, you know, all the dangers of climate change. Communities like Immokalee across the entire state are suffering more than other communities. So we're still trying to assess the impact of Hurricane Milton across the central part of Florida. And we are going to be trying to support those communities like we have done in the past. This time we were